From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is a new definition of haves and have-nots in America, and it's all about health insurance. If you lose it, and millions have, things can go very badly very quickly. Some 40 million Americans live without health insurance. My guests tonight have talked with scores of them in depth, and here's what they found. Not a health care system in America, but a new caste system. Americans can slide with frightening ease from insured to uninsured. The consequences, they say, can be devastating. Tonight on Point, the new American caste system, insured and uninsured for health care. You can join the conversation tonight. How confident are you that you and your family will always have health insurance in the American system? Have you seen how easy it is to be caught without? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Susan Starr Sered, a medical anthropologist and senior research associate at the Center for Women's Health and Human Rights at Suffolk University. Susan Sered, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us in the studio is Dr. Rushika Fernanda-Pillay. He is a physician at the Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also on the faculty at Harvard Medical School. Rushika Fernanda-Pillay, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You two together are co-authors of the new book, Uninsured in America, Life and Death in the Land of Opportunity. And it's got a lot of stories and a lot of eye-opening that goes on. I was drawn to this. You say traditionally, you say there's been this fluid kind of American society, that it's hardening into what you call a static barrier between the caste, a word very specifically chosen here, of the healthy and the caste of those who are fated to become and remain sick. Rushika Fernanda-Pillay, what's the outline of this, what you call a new caste system in America?
Well, what we found when we went and talked to people who were uninsured was that because we link health insurance to employment status in this country, it really sets up this vicious cycle we call a death spiral that can go on with people.
Death spiral.
Yes, death spiral. And it's a word that comes from the insurance lingo, actually. What it means is a kind of a self-fulfilling spiral that goes downward in a one-way direction with no way out. Let me explain to you a little bit.
And so, if you get on the wrong side of that, you're in what you're calling the uninsured caste.
Exactly.
And Susan, you're saying it's not like the old sort of class idea when everyone was middle class, everybody kind of, they didn't have the same income, but they looked the same, they had the same sense of the same base of operations. You're really describing something different here where people on the wrong side of the insurance line, the uninsured, they look different. They may smell different after a while. I mean, I don't mean it facetiously.
Yeah, no,
health issues may leave them without housing, really poor. And you're saying a caste in a much more literal sense.
Well, absolutely. I think the difference between a caste system and the kind of traditional class system we had in America is that in a caste system, there's no social mobility. You know, as Rushika was saying, we link access to health care to certain kinds of employment in America. If you don't have a job that gives you health insurance, you can't take care of your health. If you're unhealthy, you're not going to find a good job.
And this becomes a kind of permanent status,
oh,
hard
absolutely.
To escape from.
I mean, I think that if someone's uninsured for 6 months or for a year or for 2 years, if they're young, if they're basically healthy, you know, I don't think we're talking about anything that's radically different from what we knew in the past. But when we look at people who are maybe 50 years old, 55 years old, whose health is just naturally declining, if we look at people who for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years are unable to access health care in a consistent way, there are physical markers, and we know them. We're embarrassed to talk about them because that's not part of our American values. But we look at people who have rotting teeth and missing teeth and can't afford to get even basic dental care. We look at women who have distended stomachs. In fact, what they have is fibroid tumors, but no one's going to pay for treatment for that. Mm. You know, it's not cancer. They're not going to get any treatment for that if they don't have health insurance. Mm. We look at people who are squinting because they need glasses. If someone with missing teeth and squinting eyes goes to apply for a job, they're just not going to be hired. So I think that's what we're seeing emerging in the United States today.
And right along the lines of health care, you've got a lot of stories in this book, and we want to hear some of them. But what you come down to, Rushika Fernanda-Pillay, is a critique of this what sort of half-century-old connection of health care and employment. And you say that that's where the system's broken down.
Absolutely. I think when the system started, it made sense. People work in the same job their whole life. The jobs were stable, and you could link health insurance to it.
And this really started during World War II when there was competition for employees. They couldn't raise wages because of wage controls, so companies started offering competitive health care packages.
Absolutely. It actually started before World War II, but it really took off because of these wage controls. And it made sense back then. I think what we're finding now is today's economy, it makes no sense whatsoever. The vast majority, particularly new jobs coming out, don't offer health insurance to people.
The vast majority of new jobs coming out, you say, do not offer health insurance?
Yeah, particularly in the service sector, which is the fastest growing part of the economy, don't offer health insurance to people. Or if they do offer it, people can't afford to buy it because the cost sharing is so high.
So there it is. We're offering it, but it's going to cost you hundreds of dollars a month, and your wage just may not cover that.
Right. We tell one story of a lady we call Gina, who works in FabuCuts. It's a haircutting chain in Boise, Idaho.
Okay.
In Idaho.
Yep.
You know, she gets offered health insurance, which is great, but her health insurance premium is, you know, well over $200 a month, and she takes home $900 a month. That would be a significant percentage of her income, and she can't afford it.
So it's off. So either it's not offered at all, or it's offered, and very often it's too expensive. And you're saying in a majority of new jobs, are you using that metaphorically? I mean, sort of broadly speaking, or is that literally true?
I think broadly speaking, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one point that a lot of people don't understand is the majority of the uninsured. So 75% of people who are uninsured work. About 2/3 of them work full time, but 15% of them work part time. So the uninsured aren't people who are unemployed. In general, the people who have jobs just happen to have jobs that, in today's day and age, don't offer health insurance.
Susan, you talked with people all around the country in Texas, Mississippi, Idaho, Illinois, Massachusetts.
That's right.
Give us a sense. I mean, I know there are several different profiles that you found here. Some of them may seem familiar to listeners. They may imagine themselves in their shoes. Others not. Begin to tell us about some of the people you met in this country today, uninsured. Who are they? Why are they uninsured?
Yeah, I mean, there's a real variety of why people are uninsured around the country. But in all cases, really what it comes down to is the kinds of jobs that are available today. Increasingly, we see around the country that people are not being offered enough hours in low-wage jobs to be considered full-time.
Is that deliberate to keep
deliberate.
Them having to
Correct.
Offer health care because health care is so expensive?
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
So we
okay.
see all around the country people working 30 hours a week
instead
at a job.
Instead of, would 40 require health care to come with a package?
Well, that's not a legal requirement, but what happens is that companies will have a policy. So a company can say, we offer health care, we
right.
offer health insurance. But
to
in full-time fact,
full-time employees.
Yes. So people are kept right under full-time.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed many people who work two part-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they might be working 60 hours a week.
Still no access to health care through their employer.
Correct. People, for example, some of the large universities, this is a common pattern, they hire people as seasonal workers.
At universities?
So, yes, a lot of the university staff. So over the summer, they're laid off.
Oh,
so they're not permanent employees.
Again,
so
keeping them just shy of where health care would kick in.
Correct, but I think that the profiles do vary pretty dramatically around the country. In Idaho, I would say the profile that we were seeing is particularly men who traditionally had worked in mineral extraction industry and mining.
Mining,
or they worked
yeah.
in logging.
Mm-hmm.
And either the mines or the logging companies closed down, or they downsized, or they closed down and then reopened, but when they rehired people, they did not hire them with union contracts.
So if someone finds themselves in that circumstance, can they just go out, Rushika, and buy insurance, privately health insurance?
So the problem with private health insurance is that it's priced extremely high. If you think about it, the pool of people who buy private health insurance are likely to be people who are sicker. And therefore, private health insurance is what's called experience-rated, according to what they think your probability of being sick is.
And when you say it's more expensive, how much more expensive? I mean, lots of people with jobs contributing to their health care insurance will already think they're paying quite a bit. Does it really cost a lot more than that to get private health insurance?
So if you're a young person, if you're 25 years old, mm-hmm. it's actually fairly cheap
For example?
Few hundred dollars a month.
Okay.
You can get coverage that protects you from big expenses.
Catastrophic, yeah.
If you're 50 years old, that policy is going to cost you $8,000-$9,000 a month.
A month?
Absolutely. And particularly if you have a pre-existing condition. And that's part of the problem is people by that time have some condition. They have diabetes, they have heart failure, they have asthma. And either the coverage will particularly not cover the one thing you need coverage for, or it'll be priced so high.
Susan, did you find the people you talked to, and again, we'll hear more stories, but did you find them surprised to find themselves without health care?
It depends where in the country. In Mississippi and in Texas, people were not surprised. I mean, they had no expectations that life would be fair. The history of racism in Mississippi and the way that Mexican Americans have traditionally been treated in Texas, there really was no expectation that
you would get health care.
I mean, you would just consider yourself really lucky if you happened to land a job that gave health insurance in Illinois. And those were the most devastating stories. These were people who always had health insurance because they always had union jobs. They worked hard. They worked in the big manufacturing plants. When these plants relocated abroad, people lost their health insurance, and they're shocked. I interviewed many people in the Rust Belt part of Illinois. The one medicine that they're just buying because they can't bear not buying it is Prozac. They're so depressed. They're in such shock. They've had to sell their cars. They've had to sell their televisions.
To cover health care costs?
No, they can't even. Oh, they can't afford health care costs. They're selling their cars and television. Just to live.
And if on top of that they're hit with medical problems, that's when you describe them really heading into this other cast.
The
cast from terrain from which it's very hard to work your way back to the economic mainstream.
Absolutely. What people would tell me is they can't believe how quickly it happened. You know, one woman we interviewed, she was married. She'd worked in one of the big manufacturing companies. She had a white-collar job in the manufacturing company. And she said, you know, all of a sudden at the age of 40, on Wednesday my marriage ended, on Friday I lost my job. Her husband decided to leave her, trade her in for a new model. Mm. On Friday, her company downsized, lost her health insurance. That was it. She spiraled within 2 years to be a member of this cast of the ill-infirm and marginally employed.
A whole new world. Rushika Fernandopoulou, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the new American caste system, insured and uninsured for health care. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new American caste system, insured and uninsured for health care. My guests are Rushika Fernandopoulou and Susan Sered. They're authors, co-authors of the new book, Uninsured in America, Life and Death in the Land of Opportunity. You can join this conversation tonight. How confident are you that you and your family will always have health insurance in the American system? Have you ever gone without? How did it happen? Are you without now? And have you or someone you know been financially crippled by uncovered health care costs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kit is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Kit. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm one of those uninsured, terrified people out there in the world, and it's really an awful thing. I'm 50 years old, and I had insurance through work. I left work to return to school. My husband and I thought that we could afford to get insurance, but the insurance turned out to be $550 a month plus a $2,500
deductible.
Yeah. And I wound up having lumps in my breast that needed a procedure done.
Yeah.
And I'm just paying for it out of pocket. And so we dropped the insurance because it was too expensive just to keep on paying that and essentially have it go nowhere. So, you know, so here I am, 51 years old with no health insurance, and the lumps are back. So it's awful.
Kit, we can hear the concern right there in your voice. Are you worried about this dragging you down?
Well, I am, because I'm also trying to help my daughter get through school, and then I have a son who has no Medicaid right now, and he's paralyzed, so I'm trying to help him with his medical stuff as well. And I'm telling you, things have to change in this country because, you know, I know lots of people that work very, very hard to try to keep afloat, and it seems like the least little thing, and they wind up losing a lot of what they work very hard for.
Kit, we're feeling for you here. I want to try and get some advice. It's not an advice show, but Susan, if you can, what do you say to Kit? You hear her circumstances. She lives in our country today. What should she do?
You know, Kit, I don't really know what to tell you. You know, in doing the research for this book, we spoke to 120 families, and I often left their houses in tears. You know, I assume that you've tried all of the free care at the local hospitals and things of that sort.
Well, I have, but my husband, you know, is over the limit for making anything that that would allow us to qualify. And I'm a social worker, so there's a big part of me also that says, you know, I really have probably more at my disposal than a lot of people that deserve this. So I don't, you know, I don't seek that out because I want people that are probably more deserving than me to get it. I'm, you know, my point is just that I don't know very many people that have $500 out of pocket to be able to plunk down on a health insurance policy that they still have to pay the $2,500 deductible on. I just don't know people like that.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. We were all shaking our heads, nodding yes when you said that your husband earns a bit too much for you to be eligible for anything. This is something that we heard all over the country, that in some instances, if you're extremely poor, you can get more help than if you're working and making a moderate income. It does not mean that people who are extremely poor get a free ride, because they also often cannot get the services that they need. But your situation is a very frustrating one. I'm in awe and admiration at how you're taking care of your family and dealing with your son's issues. And you know, I'll keep you in my heart. I wish I had some concrete advice to give you, but the reality is there is none.
But and here's the voice of Kit says, look, I feel middle class. I didn't expect to face this. I don't want to use the social services because those are for somebody else. Yeah. But she's in this circumstance. Kit, we hear your story and we thank you for sharing it. Thanks very much for calling in. Rishika Fernandopoulou, I want to ask you about the numbers here, because just today, coming out of Washington, there is this report that the number, we've always heard 40 million, 45 million uninsured, these based on census figures, and now a new report coming out that says it's not quite as big as people thought, that it may only be 36 million, not 40, not 45. Do we know how many people are uninsured in this country?
Well, I think we don't know is the bottom line. But I don't think it matters. I think the number is big. It depends on how you ask the question. So the number we hear all the time is, you know, we used to hear all the time is 43, 45 million people came from what's called the CPS, the Current Population Survey. And they ask how many people have been uninsured for the entire year. It now turns out the study that came out today is that the way they asked that question, essentially they may have skewed the answer a little bit in the high side. If you ask a different question, how many people are uninsured for any part of the year, that number is close to 60 million, 59 million according to the last Congressional Budget Office. If you then ask the question how many people are underinsured, meaning like Kit mentioned, who they may be paying a lot of money for health insurance premium policy, but they have a huge deductible. So they are essentially uninsured up to $2,500. Then that number may even double. So the numbers are very big. And, you know, I think whether the number is 39 or 42 or 60, it's far too high, and a lot of people suffer for it.
Mm. And Susan, how does it happen? I mean, you know, the sort of picture that you try to keep in your mind is that this hopeful one where, okay, you lose your job, that had health care attached to it. Again, this is the hopeful picture. COBRA comes in, whatever that is. It kind of protects you for some months while you're out of work finding a new job. You get another job, ideally, that has health insurance and you're back in business. Or if you don't, we thought that Medicaid was supposed to be there for people who were in trouble. Doesn't that work?
No. Medicaid does work very well for people who are eligible. But the threshold for Medicaid eligibility, the income threshold, is so low in most states that if you're working at all, you cannot become eligible for Medicaid. Now, what does tend to happen around the country is that there are patches in the Medicaid system that are a little bit more liberal. So something we see very often is that children are eligible, but their parents are not. Now, this sets up a situation in which, A, sick parents are taking care of kids, which is not ideal. But it also sets up a situation that I heard about over and over again, in which parents are borrowing their kids' medication. You know, if I'm a mother, I'm having an asthma attack. Yeah. My kid has asthma medicine. I take my kid's medicine. I mean,
because you're having the attack right now.
Yeah, so I say borrow with, you know, quotation marks. I'm obviously not going to return it after I use it. It's in my system already. We find throughout the country that women, while they're pregnant, may be able to be covered by Medicaid for as long as they're pregnant, and then maybe a month postpartum.
Okay.
But once the baby's born, they're taken off of Medicaid. So the hardest stories that I heard around the country were of women who actually, well, I mean, this is a story that I really feel very strongly about and I want to share.
Please.
A woman I interviewed in Mississippi, she had her baby while she was in the hospital, and she was covered by Medicaid. She had her baby while she was in the hospital. She had just given birth. The doctor said, you want to have your tubes tied, don't you? And she agreed. Now, first of all, I don't think that's informed consent. If, you know, I have four children myself.
Yeah.
The day that you give birth,
it's not the day to be asked about
correct.
That.
But she agreed to have her tubes tied.
Madam.
And that seemed, you know, that was a decision that she made. She had two other children. I think she was not uncomfortable with that decision. A month later, she was taken off of Medicaid. Now, like many women postpartum, she didn't begin to menstruate as soon as she gave birth.
Okay.
But 2 months later, she got her first period, and she began to hemorrhage. since then, and I met her 3 years later,
yes.
Every time she got her period, she hemorrhaged. She often ended up in the emergency room. She often ended up lying in pools of blood on her living room floor. This was a complication from the tubal ligation that was done, but she was no longer covered by Medicaid. So she couldn't get treatment
and
for this.
And she had no insurance of her own.
No.
She had none through an employer.
Correct.
And so
Correct.
This is just part of her
Correct.
Life.
And worse than that, she actually was working. She was working as a nursing home aide. But she had become so debilitated from the bleeding that she was working in a very spotty way at the point that
mm-hmm.
I met her.
Mm-hmm.
So she had very little income. She certainly didn't have health insurance. Nursing homes are notorious for keeping employees in a non-insured kind of job.
And there, in a horrible kind of nutshell, you have this caste system again.
Absolutely.
She is essentially trapped by her
Absolutely.
Medical condition.
Absolutely.
And she's unlikely to get out of that.
That's right. And I visited her house. I mean, this is a woman who is articulate. Her house is clean. Her house is neat. She's really stuck now. Her health is being wrecked. And she'll occasionally get a workup done at the hospital, and some plan of action will be drawn out for her, but then no one can pay for her to pursue it.
And here, and I hope this story doesn't come to this point, but Rishika Fernanda-Pillay, you describe what you call the death spiral, and you mean it quite literally. People, describe what you're talking about there.
Yeah, well, the word death is intentionally chosen. There's lots of data the Institute of Medicine has reviewed, which really show that if you're uninsured, you have a higher probability of dying. Your mortality is higher. If you have a given disease, you will die earlier because of it, because you don't get the care you need.
And the stages of this spiral, I mean, you describe a kind of catch-22 where you can't get employed because you're too sick, or you're sick and so you lose your job and you lose your health insurance. Either way, you're not covered.
Exactly. And people start this spiral in two different ways. Either they get sick, which causes them to not be able to work, and which means they lose their health insurance, means they can't get their illness better, so they'll never get a job. Or else it starts with losing the job. Losing health insurance, your medical problems don't get taken care of, and then you don't get a job again.
Now, for listeners out there tonight who think, well, I've got a pretty good income, I'm in a pretty good situation, this is not my problem. Leaving aside the sort of collective aspect of this for a minute, who's vulnerable to this and who's not? I mean, if you have a household income of, I don't know, some six figures, are you beyond vulnerability?
The way we kind of phrase it, the way we thought is you have more handholds along the spiral. You have a little bigger reserve, so you can take a few more shots. If you start off with less assets, less support systems, one bad thing, one job loss, one illness could wipe you out. If you have more, it just may take one or two of them. But that happens to people.
Even from that kind of tier of our society, Susan, people fall into this situation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of this is age-linked. So stories that we heard over and over again were of young adults who grew up in really reasonably affluent families, went to college, graduated mm-hmm. college, could not get jobs that give health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
People with education degrees, the only jobs they can get are as substitute teachers. Now,
right.
they're working every day, but they're called substitutes. They don't have health insurance.
They're not covered.
Not covered.
And, but they're young, they're healthy, they hope.
But, you know, we interviewed a number of young people who said, oh, yeah, I'm really healthy, but, you know, when I went for my free pap smear, which I was
yeah.
savvy enough to know to get, they said that there are some cells that don't look quite right and I should be coming back every 6 months. So we were hearing stories of budding health problems in young adults, which if they're not taken care of, they are going to spiral down into serious health problems.
We have a lot of callers who want to join us tonight. I want to get to them. Mike is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Mike. I had insurance for 10 years, but this year I dropped my insurance because it went up to $253 a week.
A week, and so you just dropped it.
I had to drop it. I had no option. I thought the best thing is for my family to survive, rather than just keep giving this money to the insurance, then I go home with nothing. It doesn't really make sense.
And so now you're saving $253 a week, but you have no health insurance coverage for your family.
I do not have. I was living in an apartment. My kid is ready to go to college in 3 years' time. She will be going to college. So I decided I would rather buy a house than probably refinance for my kid to go to school in the next three years. Rather than keep putting this money into the insurance, I'll just gamble. I know something can happen, but I can't afford the insurance. It's just too much.
This is a tough decision to make. Rishika, what do you say to Mike? Has he made a rational decision here when it's up to $253 a week for insurance? He feels he can't afford it. He's dropped it. Is he playing? I mean, he's obviously playing with fire, but is it rational at a certain point?
I think we met many, many people who were forced to make these kind of Faustian trade-offs. and they were faced with two bad options, either taking home no salary or being bare without health insurance. And it's a hard position to be in. We had people who, could afford food versus their medications.
Mike, we're feeling for you. It seems a really... it seems just an unfair situation to be in. I have a friend who works as a baker. He was on long enough to get health insurance, but when he saw what it cost, it was such a big portion of what he took home, he was debating, how can I do this?
Yeah, and many of the people that we interview, there's really nothing to debate. They clearly can't afford it. But Mike, what I find really important and distressing in your story is that essentially you're choosing between reasonable housing and health care. And this is a choice that we heard about over and over again. I can't tell you how many interviews I had with people, and not just really, really poor people in Mississippi, but middle-class people in Illinois and Massachusetts as well. I would speak to them. We'd have a lovely conversation. You know, they'd serve me coffee and cake and put a good spin on their lives. After my tape recorder was off and I was walking with them to the door, I mean, I'm just remembering one man in Illinois. As I was walking to the door with him, he said to me, but, you know, I can't sleep on the street. I have to pay my rent. I can't. And he knew he needed medical treatment. He actually had a health problem that had been diagnosed, but he just couldn't put the money into the health care because he was so terrified
of having no
that he'd be homeless.
Live.
And this was a middle class man, and his fear, I mean, it just oozed out of every pore. And I thought he couldn't even tell me this while I was tape recording. It was, you know, whispering it to me as I was walking out the door.
Mike, may health be with you and your family. Charles is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to know what the effects are going to be of this new bankruptcy bill. According to the information about bankruptcies that was circulating during the debate on the bill, a lot of the people who were facing bankruptcy was due to medical problems, as it was, and was, is this this one of the factors that the authors saw that were that are reflecting the statistic? And then, what is that going to mean? What is the new bankruptcy bill going to do to this cast?
We've got it, Charles. We'll pick it up. And thanks for your call. And yes, as you write, 1.5 million personal bankruptcies filed in 2002, for example, between 1/3 and 1/2 resulted from medical bills. 1/3 and 1/2 of all bankruptcies resulting from medical bills. And now there's this new legislation. President Bush is happy to sign it. That will make it much tougher to get out of bankruptcy. Yet we're told that judges are supposed to come in here and look at the situation and be merciful if there are medical issues. Rishka, what's your sense of how this is going to affect people with medical problems and no insurance?
Yeah, so the medical debt issue is a huge one that's not talked about enough. I think talking about the caste system, getting saddled with a huge amount of medical debt locks people into this caste of being poor and sick and uninsured. Almost everyone we talked to owed thousands and tens of thousands of dollars to some healthcare institution. And it just happens over and over again. Again, the place of last resort when you're uninsured is to go to an emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
Emergency rooms have to evaluate you and potentially treat you.
But then
you get the bill.
I sort of thought that bill went off somewhere else.
No, so some hospitals have what they call free care programs, where if you qualify, and the qualifications are very variable, they forgive the bill. The vast majority will still bill you, however. The other kind of crazy thing about the system is the bill is way out of line with what an insured person would pay. I had a patient who came to see me last week, actually. He had a sore throat, was uninsured, went to an emergency room, into a local ER, was seen for 10 minutes by a doctor who gave him an antibiotic. The simple thing would have cost about $30 in the doctor's office.
Yeah.
He got charged $720.
And you write at New York Methodist in Brooklyn, $2,500 for a two-day stay for appendectomy if you're covered by insurance. If you're not, $14,000 for the same treatment. But what about Charles' question? This new legislation, what will be the impact be of tougher bankruptcy legislation on people with medical problems?
So I think this vast number of people who do accumulate all this medical debt, their one way out is declaring bankruptcy. The whole point of the bankruptcy law is a chance to get a fresh start. I think if you make it harder for people to do that, you're going to see a lot more people who are even further trapped in this caste system.
We're talking tonight about the new American caste system, insured and uninsured for healthcare. My guests, Rishika Fernanda-Poulet and Susan Starr Sarid, co-authors of the new book, Uninsured in America, Life and Death in the Land of Opportunity. You can join us tonight. Can you see the class line, the caste line that runs between healthcare haves and have-nots today on an American street. Can you guess at a glance who has health coverage and who does not? And have you come to accept that the lawn guy, the roofer, the hairdresser doesn't have health insurance? Can you imagine that it could be you uncovered one day? Is it now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new American caste system, insured and uninsured, for health care. My guests, Rushika Fernanda-Poulet and Susan Sarid, co-authors of the new book, Uninsured in America, Life and Death in the Land of Opportunity. You can join us. Can you imagine that it could be you uncovered one day? Is it you uncovered now, and how did it happen? Why can't we get this problem fixed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Londonderry, New Hampshire. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi there. I consider myself the walking dead. I'm 60 years old, and I don't intend to make it to my Social Security and Medicare. Back in 97, I had some major surgery done on my esophagus, and I was told then I had good insurance then. I was working for a company that gave good insurance,
yeah.
And they sold out to another company, and now I'm a security guard. And I'm working as much as 50 hours a week at times, and I don't have any insurance.
Zero, none.
None.
And what's your medical condition today, Jim?
Well, I was told by the doctor at that time if I go in every year and have a tube go down my esophagus and check it out to make sure I don't have any cancer, and I was doing that while I had the insurance. And 2 years ago, when I was out of a job. No insurance. I couldn't pay for the Cobra. That was over $500 a month, and
right.
I was making like $1,000 a month to live on, you know?
So you've decided you're the walking dead. You're not going to make it to your Social Security age. How do you feel about all this, Jim?
I was told by my doctor that if I don't take care of myself, I won't get about another 10 years, 10, 15 years. You know, I'm cancer-prone. And so I know every time I feel pain in my chest nowadays, down by my esophagus, the first thing I'm thinking of is I've got cancer.
And do you feel written off by society? Do you feel like it's just tough luck, mister?
Well, tough luck's not the word for it. I was all for it when Clinton was trying to put through the medical health care for everybody, but the Republicans have a perspective of... let us die, you know. they on top on the hill there. They got insurance. They can be taken care of.
You bet they do.
With the best of health for nothing. But I can't even go into emergency room without. I had blood work done about a half a year ago, and it cost me over $800 for the blood work that I had to pay out in cash, and I only make $1,000 a week a month.
We got it, and you sound like the very sort of self-defined caste, and I'm sorry to say it, that my guests are talking about tonight, and we wish you good luck. Let me get another call here. John is calling from Greenville, North Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Tom, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I agree with Jim's perspective. I'm a physician, and I've actually been working in the rural areas of North Carolina treating hundreds, if not all of my patients in a similar situation economically, many of them from foreign countries, many of them immigrants. One aspect that is actually a kind of a safety net is that there are clinics that are subsidized by the federal government that offer a sliding fee program.
Yes.
Based on income. So that saved a lot of my patients from having to go to the emergency room for the simple primary care that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't reach everybody, and certainly geographically it's limited as far as where people can get access.
And John, you're a doctor. You see people in exactly these circumstances. What do you think about this idea that we've come to kind of write off a tier of America as a different caste, not deserving, or just they're going to have to live or die
Absolutely.
With their problems?
The economics of the generation that is coming through, the baby boomers, is that basically they were taken care of by their jobs and by the economy, and now that it's become more a fend-for-yourself type of economy, people can't fit it into their fiscal, they can't actually afford it. One concern I have is, where is the justification on the insurance industry's aspect for justifying these horrendous rates for people who want to get self-insured when the charges that the physicians and the treatment have not actually gone up that proportionately?
You're seeing insurance rates go up higher than actual cost of treatment. We'll ask. John, thanks for your work there, and thanks very much for calling. Rashika Fernandopoulay, what about the issue? I mean, it is the issue over all this of a solution. There have been so many ideas, attempts, committees, conferences, you name it. Why can't we get past this? Are we doomed to live with whatever it is, 30, 35, 40, 60 million uninsured Americans? Where's the solution out there?
I think finally people need to get fed up and say this is not a tolerable situation. And I think people realize this could happen to me. This is not a problem of those other poor people out there. This affects all of us. It affects us in a lot of ways. I think once we realize that, we might make some progress. I think about solutions. A lot of what's on the docket today is about incremental solutions. Let's build some more community health centers to help the people uninsured. Let's change the Medicare age from 65 to 60. Let's raise the Medicaid eligibility to a little bit. The problem is those don't really work. I think what our book and our research really showed us is that we need to fundamentally break this link between employment and health insurance. Every other country, almost every other industrialized country has figured this out, and we haven't yet.
In other words, don't depend on the employer, then depend on what?
You need to make it a public responsibility. I think the public school system is a very good analogy. You know, we certainly don't depend on employers to provide for education for their employees' children. We think that's a public responsibility, and therefore we treat it that way. And I think that's what we need to start thinking about health care.
You're talking universal health care provided by the government.
Again, there's lots of semantics around that.
Yep.
Again, thinking about the public school system as a good analogy, you know, there is a system of schools which is provided for free for people as a condition of being a resident of the United States. There are people, however, buy up and get tutoring and get other sorts of services. So it's not mandated this is the only sort of place to go. A lot of people,
but a baseline that everyone could count on.
Absolutely.
Susan, what's your sense of Americans? Are they ready for this? Are they hungry for it? Or have Americans who are in comfortable situations decided, you know what, I'm afraid that would somehow diminish the quality of my own health care or cost me more. I'm ready to live with this caste of less well-served countrymen and women.
That's really a fabulous question. And, you know, one of the few encouraging things that I can say, having been around the country and spoken to people in some of the most conservative areas of the country, as well as some of the more progressive parts of the country, everyone has the same problems. You know, we live in fragile bodies, we get sick, and I hear from people who are Republicans, people who are Democrats, we really need to have a basic level of assurance that we can be taken care of when we're sick, so that we can take care of our families, we can take care of ourselves. So I do think that there is a budding consensus in the country, and I think increasingly there's just about nobody who feels that they're totally immune from the problems of being uninsured, because everyone is seeing either their kids who are post-college not getting jobs with health insurance, or they're seeing their friends without health insurance. There's really almost nobody today who's escaping the pull of the death spiral.
It comes close to home. Yet a lot of interest at play here, and it has been a very, very difficult knot to cut through. We'll see what happens. Your reporting and writing can only help here, and we're grateful to you for it. Rashika Fernandopoulay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Susan Starr Sarid, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Co-authors of Uninsured in America. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Senate Finance Committee begins to tackle Social Security reform. This is On Point. After months of debate on the airwaves, on talk shows, and town hall meetings, the fight over Social Security entered a new phase this morning as the Senate Finance Committee began grappling with real proposals to make the system solvent long-term. The hearings waded through four different plans and looked at options with and without supplemental private accounts. Joining me now from Washington for the latest on the debate in today's hearings is Bill Nykirk, senior Washington correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Bill, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
So a lot of doing at the Finance Committee today, and we're going to hear some of that. I want to jump right in with a sense to kind of set the tone at the top. Here's Senate Finance Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa saying the time is now for Congress to do something about Social Security.
All I hear from members of Congress and from people on the outside is no plan. And I want to talk to people about plans. I don't even care if you don't talk to me. Those of you that are bad-mouthing every other suggestion out there, suggest your own plans. You don't have to talk to me. I'm willing to do it. But we need to get some discussion going. Doing nothing is not an option, because doing nothing is a cut in benefits. Grandpa Grassley gets Social Security, but my granddaughter, when she retires 56 years from now, if we do nothing, is going to get this cut that you're talking about. You can rationalize it all you want to, but by golly, she's entitled to what I got, because her dad and younger people are paying for it.
Senate Finance Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa today, and you can hear the emotion right there. Bill Nykirk, bring us up to date on where this whole debate is right now. What's happening with this Finance Committee hearings? What point has all this reached? We're well into President Bush's 60-city barnstorm for change. Where do things stand right now, and what's the meaning of these hearings?
Well, as a matter of fact, the 60 days is almost up, and
yeah.
Bush has done very little actually to sell the plan to the country, to the public. In fact, polls are going down. And Grassley wanted to hold hearings because he wanted to get something going, something started. Obviously, nothing was happening. At least he thought that getting some specific proposals on the table would sort of narrow the debate and get people thinking about how to deal with this legislatively. Alas, the first day didn't wind up very well. It was the same old partisan clash that we've always had. Democrats weren't willing to come to the table with a specific proposal and stuck to their guns that they were not going to negotiate unless President Bush dropped the private plans. While Republicans in general seemed to back the president's plan, general idea of personal accounts, except for a couple of Republicans, notably Senator Olympia Snowe and Senator Thomas from Wyoming, who expressed some doubts about personal accounts. And I think at the end of the day, there was a feeling that this is going to be a very, very difficult job for Senator Grassley to get any kind of bill out of committee.
Of course, he's saying he wants to do that and do it in June or July, but the criticism around the private accounts very strong today. Let's listen to a little bit of that. Here's Montana Democrat Max Baucus asking Brookings Institution's Peter Orszag how much it would cost to set up private accounts, as President Bush has suggested, and whether such accounts would make any difference in helping Social Security's long-term financial health.
These plans require a lot of borrowing.
Trillions of dollars in debt.
Trillions of dollars, additional to, on top of.
That is correct.
I might want to make one point clear here, too, if you might, Mr. Orszag. I've heard people say, gee, what's wrong with a $2 trillion down payment for $11-12 trillion unfunded liability? Isn't it true that $2 trillion is an add-on? It's in addition to the $11 trillion, and that over time the $2 trillion would get paid back, but that leaves untouched the 75-year, the 100-year, or the long-term unfunded liability of Social Security.
That's absolutely right. This is a complete bait and switch. People talk about the cost of the accounts and then talk about the actuarial deficit in Social Security. The accounts do nothing to reduce the long-term insolvency of Social Security. Arguing that they do is like arguing that snake oil will help to cure strep throat, because if you take snake oil along with an antibiotic, your strep throat goes away. The snake oil is not doing anything to get rid of the strep throat. The accounts are not doing anything to get rid of your $11 trillion deficit.
Peter Orszag of the Brookings Institution talking there with Montana Democrat Max Baucus. And, Bill, snake oil language, not exactly the language of compromise.
Not exactly. And Orszag has a point that this personal account program will require huge borrowings in the beginning to set them up. And as a result, we would go into debt. And he also says it would be borrowing that we have to finance in the markets, which could affect our economy as well. Whereas now we can just put this, just to have this implicit debt in the future and not deal with it for a while, He makes a good point about that. But on the other hand, you're right. It doesn't show any aspect of compromise at all. And I think this is a somehow, some way, politicians are going to have to get together in the way Tip O'Neill would get people together and Reagan got people together in 1983 and do some good old-fashioned horse trading. But, you know, there hasn't been much of that in this Congress, and I think things have changed dramatically in our politics, the way we campaign these days.
And the kind of principled commitment to private accounts, with everything that they suggest, still very much alive. And I want to hear just a bit of that, if we may, Bill. Here's the Cato Institute's, another man testifying today, Cato Institute's Michael Tanner, responding to Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden's concerns about the risk involved in investing Social Security funds in private accounts.
Maybe you're right. Maybe private investment is risky. I don't believe it is riskier than Social Security, which contains a substantial political risk. The fact is that we've promised benefits, we can't deliver them. The fact is we've repeatedly reduced or changed benefits in the past. The fact is we don't have a legal right to any benefits whatsoever, leaving us entirely on the political system.
My time is short.
Sure.
This is not about whether you favor risk in America. I vote repeatedly to cut capital gains, for example, because I'm in favor of risk-taking in investment. Tell me why you favor redirecting Social Security funds towards more risk.
I favor giving workers a choice. If workers agree with you that Social Security is safer than private investment, let them remain in the current system. But if workers want the opportunity to earn a better rate of return, to have ownership and control, give them the choice. Don't stand in the doorway and say that we know better for every worker how they should control their retirement. Let's give workers a choice. What could be more American than that?
More American than that. Bill Nykerk, so where does this leave things? The talk going in was that there would be legislation in front of the Senate by June or July. That's just a month or two away now. With or without Democratic support, is that still in the cards, or are you saying this is going to die in committee and have to wait for another congressional season?
I think Grassley's committed to going forward with a vote, with or without Democratic support, on a plan. He acknowledges that he may not be able to do personal accounts. If that's too controversial and unpopular and Democrats just stiff him on it. He's willing to consider a plan just to deal with the solvency issue of Social Security itself.
They have 55 Republicans in the Senate. Can they pass something without the Democrats?
It's possible. If you could run up against that 60-vote filibuster
business
vote,
as
you would not, as a nuclear option only deals with judges, and if you have this still on Social Security, you may have a difficulty passing it. But it would be, I don't think the public support is there as yet. I don't think that, I do think you have to have public support and bipartisan support for an overhaul in Social Security.
And you may not get it this time. Bill, I'm afraid we're out of time with that, but thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Bill Nykerk with the Chicago Tribune. He spoke with me from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.